Well, I think you've given us an enormously rich feast of ideas and histories and archival sources to draw on. I'm sure we won't be able to tease out all the implications of that lecture in the next half hour or so, but I'd like to open it up for questions or comments.
It's always difficult to ask the first question. I'm kind of still formulating. Thank you very much, Professor Butter, for an extraordinary lecture, which addresses so many things. I found myself at the stage where, in a wonderful move of thought, you drew our attention to the fact that the homogeneous nation state is predicated upon chaos and confusion, upon multiplicity. I find myself asking to what extent the teleological project of Europe draws its force from a history which Europe constructs, or has constructed for itself, of a movement from polytheism to monotheism. So with the unity of God, shall we say, as considered right. And I'm simply too ignorant, being so terribly entrenched in Europeanness myself, I think. I find myself asking, what does it look like to somebody who comes at Europe from outside Europe? I think I was seeing some answers in what you were saying about the relation of sects in India to each other, but still, as it were, defined as minorities. I wasn't quite sure, defined as minorities in relation to what. I'm not formulating a question, am I? I'm seeing, as it were, a potential contrast. Between Europe and Europe's outside as well, or that which is not Europe.
I think I'll try and respond. First, the question of chaos. In fact, there's some point in emphasizing this notion of order derived from chaos in some interesting reflections written in a form of internal exile. The Victor Klemperer, the Romanist, in his diaries, pointed out that what was happening in Germany at that time, this was about the 40s or so, was a redefinition of what Europe is. And he said that what is happening is we are creating the notion of Europe as Festung Europa, Fortress Europe, and this term is used by him. And because the hordes are outside and they're standing at our gates, so the notion of beleaguered state of Europe is an integral part of this ideology of, or the stereo, sorry, not ideology, the stereological movement, which says that chaos is part of our past. We have moved from that because that is progress. Progress is defined by ability to move away from something that was in the past. But other peoples do not have histories. They are still in that stage of chaos which we have overcome. And therefore the conflict between Festung Europa and the rest of the world is along this line. And this line, by the way, need not necessarily then be a line in the Balkans in that sense. It can also be an intellectual line. It can also be a theoretical line. But that line, again, which Klemperer uses the term, this line exists and it is being reinforced every day. Now from that, what I would suggest is that the important point for my, or as I look at it, the important why it was not the movement in Europe from polytheism to monotheism, because that is also there in other parts of the world, and Islam is based on a very firm affirmation of a monotheistic order. But it was of combining various things, sort of a Max Weber's question of why only Europe and why not the rest of the world, of combining various factors in the conflict which existed in a complex situation towards a drive towards modernity, which then became linked to a colonial project. As far as minorities are concerned in India, what I meant here was the distinction which is made on the basis of religion. And just as Herder, in his argument to grant the Jews citizenship in Germany based on the fact that actually they belong to a different country in terms of the law that they respect, and they have to learn how to carry their Palestine with them as a portable Palestine, no matter what they are, otherwise they cannot become part of our culture. In the same way, what the homogenization forces in India, such as Hindutva and others, would do is to say that territorially the religion of the majority, which is their version of Hinduism, which is of course also a debatable notion, that is opposed to a minority religion which actually is alien. Entry into our soil. This is the notion of our soil. The words are the same, the soil, blood and all that. There seems to be a congruence also in the way in which the theories have been absorbed. And this minority is then, however, that's what I wish to affirm, is not necessarily then exterminated, but it is put in its place. That is probably the long, in the long term, that is a more successful strategy than to try and exterminate the minority. Because it then perpetuates the difference, but puts it very firmly in its place. That is what I was trying to say. Yes?
Well, I'd also like to thank you. I found that immensely rich talk. I would like to read it more slowly and have time to really think it through. I mean, just one small point along the way. I think you suggested these different possibilities that a minority community of some sort might identify itself as such, might have some kind of representation in the national state, and to that extent it would actually deprive itself of full citizenship in a certain sense. And of course I can see that as a, you know, that seems a very strong, you know, you bring a good focus onto a political dynamic of a certain sort. I'm just wondering, since we're also thinking at a more utopian level, you know, the humanism project yet far from finished, I mean, could one also think about that at a level of principle? You know, in other words, is that just a fact that that's how things have been historically, or must it be that way in principle? I mean, you're thinking of the recent things in France. I'm a pretty much a secularist, and I support the idea, I have no religion whatnot, you know, in the public sphere. On the other hand, I might interpret this in a different way, not say that you can't wear up, you can't come to school wearing your ethnic or communal clothes, so much as to say, well, everyone can turn up wearing anything they bloody want to, because it doesn't matter, it has no meaning in the public space. That's the way I would like it to be, so that in a sense, it seems to me when we get to that stage, one would have both of these things, they'd be added to each other. Would that be part of the, you know, would that be consonant with the argument you were making?
Yes, first of all, thank you. First of all, let me apologize for the fact that I have an inherent inability to read out a manuscript which is written, which is why the text that I have was presented in a slightly chaotic way. But I'm certainly the text will be available for anybody who wishes to read it. As far as what I was trying to suggest is that as a result of, or put it this way, in the freedom struggle in India, the notion of reserved constituency was developed. So elections took place and seats were reserved in parliament depending on who was a Muslim or who was from this region and so on and so forth. And then the notion of who represented an entire community came up. And this representative was the person you negotiated with. To what extent that person actually represented anybody was entirely debatable, and very strongly so did that person represent any in some way emancipatory questions such as women and I mean, you can think of so many examples. So that's what I meant was that the very tolerant notion of a democratic representation in parliament, as it evolved out of the British colonial empire and as the Indian colonial struggle, was to solve problems by at least getting hold of somebody who can then say, okay, that is the representative for that religion. Okay, and then we talk to him. And it's his business to find out whether he gets the support of his constituency and all. So this constituency-based representational act of a parliamentary order is what I was saying, is what is in effect taking place in multicultural societies. Now, I certainly would, as far as France is concerned, I certainly would say that something very similar is being debated there. I mean, I forget the name of the cleric who's now very popular as the spokesman of Islam in France, in the context of this debate which was going on with Gog's murder and so many other things, this whole question. But that's not the real point. The question was then that they reserve for themselves then the right as representatives to say that the entire community thinks like this, and this is where the problem ultimately starts. Whether the solution to the problem is that school should say everybody can wear what they jolly well like, or to follow a good old English example and say that all school children must have uniforms, and that would solve the question of the difference completely. That I think is on which we can have an open mind. I rather like the notion of school uniforms, I must say, because they're very popular in India. But I know that this may not be the solution which is acceptable to most people. So, But I think that the question of representation of a community, and therefore saying that because I am the interpreter of a book in the capacity of being a cleric or a priest or holding the post of the head of a religious institution, grants to me in the liberal state a voice, which is then heard because it solves problems. That's the thing.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could flesh out your discussion of Goethe's differentiation or prioritization of equality before tolerance, because I mean, from my sort of understanding, a lot of critiques that have come, especially from post-colonial feminist theorists, is that precisely renders equality to be a formulaic version of equality or constitutional equality, but how does it sort of actually translate into you know, practice?
I can only give you an answer from literature.
Yeah.
But by no means was Goethe suggesting that what is required is a formulaic equality he was not talking like Habermas in terms of a Fasson. Mm-hmm. That was not the point. What he was trying to establish was a notion of substantive equality, which is based on the possibility of mutation. And just give an example. The model that he has is his divan, in which for a space of 10 years, he posed and acted as though there was some identity called Goethe, whose actual name is Hafiz, but not Goethe anymore. And he's Hafiz for 10 years. This substantive equality between what he thought was Islamic or Oriental culture or Persian culture, whatever you want to call it, and his classical German, Greek, Greco-Roman, German heritage, gave to a constellation in literature that notion of equality which he thought was possible in a society, in which the question was not of tolerance, but the If I may put it in a slightly linguistic sort of way, it is equality in the mode, in the conjunctive, subjunctive mode, equality in the subjunctive mode, as a possibility. The moment you can imagine that you could be something else, you have an equality which is not a formulaic equality, but you have a substantive equality. And this is not the same as saying that I myself can be the other. That is a hermeneutic question. This is not a hermeneutic question. This is a question of in society in which there are many differences, to say that equality principle is a principle which is the possibility that I may have be the something else also, and vice versa. Now, if you want to put it more bluntly, if religion X and religion Y cannot have a position of saying that X can always become Y and Y can always become X, then they are not substantively equal. That is what Goethe was working towards. And by the way, Goethe's reflections were very strongly based on what he saw of certain Bashkirit groups which had come to Weimar at that time, and he participated in the rites and all that. He found it very interesting, in a very dignified sort of way, very interesting, and there is a certain amount of aristocratic, which of course we must then ignore if possible.
Oh, thanks. I really look forward to reading the paper as well, because there are various passages where I wasn't quite sure. But I wanted to ask you one question, really of illumination, about one of the passages, and maybe link it up to another. It's the notion of knowledge of the division of Europe into those with a knowledge of colonization, colonialism, and those without the knowledge of colonialism. I was just trying to work through in my mind what's at stake here.
Okay.
And in particular, I suppose what came to mind was a notion that I'm not entirely persuaded by, which is the sort of Habermas idea of learning from experience, learning from history. That if, that Europe, Germany learned from the history of the Holocaust that certain kinds of nationalism was totally unacceptable, or certain European countries learned from the history of colonialism that creating confusion, as you put it in that way, is not a way forward. And that idea of sort of learning from history is very endogenous. It's you have an experience and then you learn from the experience by communicating really with yourself. I wonder how true that is, first of all, that it's a rather sort of sanitized view of Europe, that Europe or Western Europe has learned from these experiences. But I was also wondering how that fits in with what you were saying towards the end about connected histories and about communication and about not seeing sort of culture as sealed, as a sort of autonomous unit. And that conception of sort of those countries with knowledge of, what do you call it, colonial competence. There's a conception you're developing which is not of a kind of endogenous learning experience, but of something else, and I'm wondering if you could follow that through.
I'll try and elaborate briefly on that. The quote I gave from the Hungarian writer Nagash was actually meant to emphasize his sense of divergent trajectories through which people or nations in Europe are coming together. Nagash is a Hungarian, so he has this experience of East European, Soviet-oriented experience, but he's also very aware of the Austro-Hungarian past, he's one of those who knows this past very clearly. What he was basically trying to say, and that was in the context of what was happening in Yugoslavia, the intervention in Yugoslavia, he was talking in that amount, he was saying that Europe is not a united Europe already. In other words, he was in fact making a point which I also subsequently did try to make, that Europe was also an unfinished project. And the reason why it's not a unified place as Europe is because it has as members countries which can appeal to different experiences of rule and control of the rest of the world. And by implication, that is what I have then translated in my own language as colonial competence, so that you have places like Britain or France or Spain and Portugal and the Netherlands, who as a result of their involvement in colonialism were able to deal with the question of alienness, of foreign migrations, in a way in which, shall we say, the Hungarian people are unable to do so. He was trying to put that. This does not mean that the British are solving the question of migration, or that it's good, that what they are doing is good, or that the French are dealing with the Arab or the Algerian question correctly. That's not the thing. But they know what the problem is. That's what he was trying to say, in the sense that somewhere there's an archive of colonialism, whether it's repressive or whether it is liberationist, and whatever it is, they can appeal to. Whereas in East Europe, you do not have this experience, is what he was saying. And therefore, out of this knowledge of the past we have, you have in Europe different voices to deal with something like Yugoslavia, intervention, the question of ethnic cleansing, the question of should many people live together although they belong to different religions and speak different languages. Does it make any sense to anybody in the world to say that Serbo-Croatian are two different substantive languages, which is, I think, one of those absurdities, as absurd as saying that Hindi and Urdu are two different languages. All these sort of questions, his point, I'm not necessarily endorsing his point of view, but what I'm pointing out is that he's one of the few voices who have pointed out that Europe is based on a different world experience in itself. And one world experience is the colonial experience, available in certain parts of Europe, and the other experience is what you might call a non-colonial experience of people who themselves were, for at least 30 or 40 years, not able to be part of this treatment. That's all he was pointing out to. And as a result of this, there would be tensions in Europe evolving into a common, mentally definable space. So, in fact, what he was making was a rather negative prognosis of saying that if Europe has to come together on the basis of something called Europeanness, to use it that way, that it would be a very difficult thing, because he, as a European, Hungarian European, would not be able to react to Yugoslavia in the same way as a French would do. That is what his point is.
Can I just have a footnote addition to that? Does that incorporate the notion that in Eastern Europe, there may be an experience of being colonized?
Yes, of course, that's what he says, explicitly.
Rather than being the experience of
If I'm not read that out, that was a mistake. No, he explicitly said, and those people who themselves were colonized. Europe has people who colonized and people who themselves were colonized. I'm sorry if I did not make that clear. And as a result of that, but it was nothing. This has nothing to do with the Habermasian kind of notion of learning from experience. Nadesh's point, which is why I included it in my argument, is not that Europe is therefore learning from experience, but that it has an archive which is very different from within itself. In other words, it was a plea to people who, like me, are trying to study Europe, to not take Europe as a unified whole already, but again, as something that is evolving. And therefore he pointed out this, that don't forget this point, which actually not many people emphasize. They emphasize perhaps that there's regional difference, and there's language difference, and all sorts of differences, but they do not emphasize the difference in history that has been incorporated into the structures of the European state. And this, of course, by implication, because Nadesh is very strongly aware of Nadesh is one of those who defends the notion of Central Europe. And this is also because he has a special theory of what fascism meant. He has studied, most of his writings deal with the question of Holocaust and Germany, and his love-hate relationship with Germany is one of the motors of his novels, which are very powerful novels.
I think we've got three more questions, and then four more questions. Yeah.
Really, I think you answered my question, because I wanted to point out the experience of being colonized in Eastern Europe. That wasn't clear to me either.
Yes, I'm sorry I did not emphasize that, but that is the point.
Well, this is in a sense a follow-up on Robert's question, because I think I was exercised by a similar point. I think that one of the authors who you brought to mind for me, though I don't think you referenced him, several times in the talk, was Renan and his concept of selective amnesia as being absolutely at the core of nationalism, that instead of banging on about the things that children are forced to learn and remember to belong to a nation, the things in which we are all forced to forget in order to feel that we are common with the other people in our nation. And then when you refer to the archive of historical knowledge, that, say, that Hungarians might not have, because Hungary had not been a colonial power, but the Britons might. I think that what we have to then bear in mind is that that archive is accessed and repressed unevenly, both over time, over space, and among different persons within the population, that perhaps working class women know and repress a different archive of historical experience than aristocratic men, and that also changes over time, and perhaps even over the region. So I guess it's that complexity makes the concept of the archive one that I think we have to destabilize. It's many archives, and not everybody has a pass to get into the archive, or can stay for as long as everybody else. Not everyone can bring a laptop and thus take out, you know, as much. I'm an archival historian, so I'm rather enjoying this. I'll stop, I promise. But I guess it's this concept of the archive is also one that, as an historian, we find deeply problematic as well. And that's, again, maybe it's not a question so much as a comment.
I think that it's an important point, and I think, I tend to agree with what you're saying. First of all, archive is certainly not a closed or a monolithic order, and the ability to access this archive is also based on power relations, that is granted. So in a sense, the archive that I'm talking about is a more of a Borges kind of a library. And it is not necessarily a male archive of a certain kind of a monolithic accessibility which is not granted to other people. It's not that. But it is a decent, stabilized archive with great degrees of assemblage and reassemblage, which are probably not very easy to define, and for which reason I like the term that complexity for the archive. It's a complex, what you might call, it's a complex availability of something which probably you are not very clearly aware of unless you start to deal with the question, and then it becomes a very difficult question. Something like
that. I have a question about your understanding of Orientalism and your own position actually in this debate. Your heterogeneous polycultural society also is the future model could be criticized as being an Occidentalist view. Now, this is what I'd like to ask you. I mean, would you accept that your view is to some extent what Avishai Magalit and Dean Roma called Occidentalist view, which is basically using the criteria developed in the West to understand the West, or I mean the whole question of East and West, is this still distinction that matters for you, is one of the questions, sub-questions is. Now, the whole notion of the world in terms of Western categories is also penetrating the critique of the West. The critique of the West is basically a product of Western thinking. And those who take the Western project, the West, are caught up in this notion of what is seen as the West, also by using sources that are the critiques of the West born in Western thinking. Now, would you say there is some classification of your own view is an Occidentalist view in this sense?
Well, I think it's an important question. Question which is asked very often. So what I would like to suggest is that in my way of thinking, Occidentalist position or an Orientalist position will only reaffirm dichotomies which probably are not important. If you take the position that at least the history of modernity is a history of successive interlockings and interconnectedness and shared histories, etc., in other words, world literature processes coming to this, so that the monopolization was as if the patenting of a problem in terms of cultural patenting does not take us anywhere, which is why I like the notion of an archive. You can plunder an archive, and only you have to know how to do it, which is why you need the expert's help. So it's not a question of whether one is an Occidentalist or a what is the opposite of an Occidentalist? No, not only an Orientalist, but a person who goes back into traditionalist of some real kind. I've quoted Tagore, who actually came to the West very late in terms of his thinking. He comes from a very conservative background originally. Nehru, of course, was a product of two experiences, and so quoting Nehru would probably fit into Margalit's way of saying that this is Occidentalism. To my mind, that I would say that that concepts are either productive or unproductive. And the notion of Occidentalism is not a productive concept because it actually doesn't explain anything. It only slots again. And it doesn't take anything further. So if I say that history is colonialism was an interconnection, for a process of interconnection. One is against colonialism, not in order to establish, as it were, the purity of origins and have, you know, traditional societies, etc. The whole point was, how do you go beyond a contradiction? How do you go beyond a dialectical contradiction? You do not do so by opposing colonialism in order to get back to some sort of tribal purity. And similarly, you do not you do not deal with complexity by reducing it to a reductionist position. So what I would like to say is that we should simply take the fact that one is in a historical situation as given and say that, okay, now all this what has happened, shall we say, from 1492 onwards, which is the date one could start as a compromise, one could start there, 1492 onwards happened, is in fact not so easily slottable in terms of patenting it as an act only available to a certain nation or a certain geographical territory. Because then that puts you into the problem which many other revivalists and so on and so forth fall into by saying that, no, we also have weapons, or we also have gold, or we also have the mining industry, or we also have this and all that. But that's an unproductive way of looking at it. The fact of the matter is, and here I see no reason why one should not take Weber's question very seriously, or why Europe and seriously, it's a serious question. But the answer to that is not some inherent, as it were, gene which was responsible for that, but combination of factors which we do not quite understand. And I think it's good to say that we do not understand why colonialism started in the way it started. It could just have been a reverse. It could just have happened the other way around. At that moment, I think it could have happened the other way around. But history, at some sense, and I think historians would agree with me there, and force you to come to terms with what you might call, in inverted commas, facts are. And so the history is there. And you deal with history by simply either saying that, okay, these are disconnected histories, and we go back to revivalist notions, or you say, no, they are connected. Now let's see what we can do with that connectedness. In other words, how productive is it for me to say that this is an Occidental point of view? I said, in German I would say, naunt. So what? I would say that, but is it worth suggesting that in the present juncture with internationalization, globalization, and so on and so forth, economic crises taking place, the question of homogenization and heterogenization opens up options for discussions which also have the limited number of conceptual possibilities. And the choice of whichever possibility I appeal to is justifiable only on against the background of what I think would be the possible outcome of this argument. And that is the thing. And that possible outcome, whether it is an Eastern outcome or a Western outcome, would, I think, not be such an important question. The question is it sustainable as an argument for the limited period that I have? So, which is why, I would simply say that that our answer to Margalit, many other people have said that, okay, the critiques of the present world from the third world or the former third world using Western concept is, I think, in a philosophical way of putting it, is a meaningless argument. It doesn't take us anywhere. It's true. And then, okay, if it's true, then so what? That's how we do it. Anybody who makes, as the plunders an archive, doesn't necessarily have to account for what he took.
Thank you very much. I have a lot of questions, but I'm going to pick up on some of the discussion in a sense, because what I'm trying to understand is the way that you're putting together Goethe. Mm-hmm. And the way that you're using Goethe, which I heard you as being the model of toleration that you wanted, with some of the later things that you said about palimpsest. And I'm finding that quite difficult to put together, because if we accept that the archive isn't just something that's there to be raided, so to speak, and it's got its different levels of writing and overwriting, and you can't go back to a sort of authenticity, but we've got to know how to interpret, how to plunder, how to read it, then I'm finding it difficult to think about that alongside the way that you talked about Goethe as being not to do with understanding, so it was ahermeneutical, and yet surely you've got to have a model of how to interpret in order to know what to find in the archive. So it's these two things I'm finding really difficult to keep together. And what's sort of worrying me, really, in a sense, is behind your three models of toleration, there's also the Kantian model, which has been so influential for people like Hannah Arendt and...
Yes, of course.
Yes. The notion of a sensus communis, but for Kant, it wasn't a chaos to start with. There were these four a priori racial types, and the sensus communis was, in a sense, a way of supposing that the other must be like oneself in terms of idealizing a certain kind of rational response to the other. So, like other people who are worried about what's included in the Goethe model, I'm sort of worrying in a certain sense that maybe Goethe is a bit like Kant in terms of, yeah, assimilating the other to oneself. Can you put it like that?
Not in the way that I have tried to present it. In fact, I would reclaim Goethe on the part of towards a position which I could put it this way. Let me try to put it this way. What Goethe is trying to do, and for him there is a literary model of what he has done with this way of dealing with this, is to suggest as a poetics of society that instead of interpreting first, what you do is find out how you can deal with something. And the notion of equality derives from that. So instead of first, in the model of toleration, instead of first trying to understand and then coming to terms with it, he suggests first trying to find out whether you can get along with something. And that's the way he as a writer works. I mean, in a sense, what I'm trying to say is that Goethe's notion of experimentation with new material for his poetry is the model of tolerance that he himself was advocating as a hermeneutical principle. He suddenly got a lot of material from the East, from the Orient, was sent to him by various writers. He read translation. He was fascinated by this notion. He experimented. He played around with it. Part of it also was part of his biographical situation at that time. He was playing around with the relationship also. So he was playing around. There was a notion of spiel involved in this entire material that he was playing around with. But his attitude out of this playing around with material was to affirm that he was not doing it in order to understand, like a philologist would do, understand the East. He was not trying to interpret and understand the Eastern world or to understand Hafiz. He was interested in finding out whether he could become Hafiz. Now this, I suggest, is not a Kantian principle at all. I don't think that is why I would say that Kant doesn't come into this argument in the way that I'm developing it. And when I mentioned that, and I know that Hannah Arendt is very strongly influenced by Kant, but I think the argument that Hannah Arendt was making was an argument against the Herderian analysis of how the Jews can be incorporated in Europe. And I would have to think through then the question of whether there's something Kantian in the way she's dealing with it. I've not really thought of it. So thank you very much for pointing that out as a problem. But as far as Goethe is concerned, and holding Goethe together with the notion of palimpsest and old writing, etc., I think that fits it precisely. Because what Goethe is trying to say is that all of this as an archive or as a palimpsest exists, and I have to work with it. And a palimpsest, if you have a number of overwritings, you can work with them. You can rearrange this assemblages. You can say, okay, let's take this as number one, let's take this as number five. Okay, say, no, this is for number four and this is number three. You can play around. You have an entire material to play around with, but you do not either say that one is more authentic than the other. That would be one caveat that you have to make. You do not say that. And also you do not claim that you have the power to erase something in order to affirm the importance of something else. But you can, and this is where Renan may come in also, but you can definitely say there are certain things which are more present in our minds right now, and others which are still part, which have been left out of the memory, maybe recovered later. But there's an entire ensemble of possibilities available into which you can go as and when you like, without necessarily affirming that only one of them is valid or the other is valid, and then from that position out onwards suggesting that tolerance would only take place if you can understand how other people are different. This is roughly what I was trying to do.
There are two other questions.
Yes.
I'm fascinated by the question of authorship that comes out of that, and who is authoring this kind of ensemble and so on. But anyway, I'm not going to take my privileges chair. I think we'll perhaps take two more questions and then perhaps repair to Cafe Humanities for a more informal discussion.
Yes, I think I would also agree with you that this is not the Kantian model. And I was wondering how far, because you spoke of Verwandlung,
yes.
One would be able to invoke the kind of German term of sich etwas anverwandeln,
yes.
Which is a kind of process of change which changes
much.
Both the object and the subject, which you can also find in Benjamin's concept of mimetic ability.
Exactly. Thank you for that.
In Benjamin's critique of Aristotle, that
yes.
One thing cannot be two things at the same time. And I find this very sympathetic as a kind of literary studies person. I'm very sympathetic to this. I'm just wondering in how far your concept of heterogeneity and fuzziness is compatible with the concept of secular democracy, which seems to me to be dependent on strong institutions and a concept of citizenship that depends on participation in democratic processes. And when I look at society around me, I see that this seems to be dismantled at all corners in terms of the destruction of public institutions, the invocation of multinational military companies to run databases for the government, etc., etc. And I think at that point I wanted to talk about contemporary capitalism and in what sense this, what happens economically in the world, is actually conducive to the conclusion of the unfinished project of secular democracy.
Can I link my question to Helmut, because the elevated philosophical tenor of the previous questions, mine's a boringly pragmatic one, but I think that is linked to that, even though it probably comes from a different point of view of Helmut. Your axiom of a few minutes of concepts are either productive or unproductive. Does that allow for concepts that were once productive becoming unproductive? Because that's my problem with your multiculturalism versus pluriculturalism dichotomy. If I apply it, and this is probably where I differ from Helmut, I don't know, in the pessimistic tenor of what he just said, if I apply it to the modern Federal Republic, multiculturalism, for all its warts, as it may now be seen, nevertheless was a progressive rallying call, precisely against the old sort of metaphor of the Schmelz Tiegel, the melting pot, which of course is assimilation, and in the German context has all the horrendous connotations that we're aware of. And multiculturalism was productive in the boring, pragmatic end product of changing the nationality laws, for example, in Germany, which actually is linked to one of the basic fundamentals of democracy, the right to vote.
No, I couldn't agree more with you, but let me try and proceed from my own thing. Basically, this notion of fuzziness, etc., is one could say, is an affirmation of saying that there is no principle of exhaustive choice that you are appealing to. You're not saying either or all the time. You're saying sowohl als auch, both this and that, as a cognitive way of looking at the world. So it is possible to be many things. And thank you very much for, when I refer to Benjamin, I was thinking of my of the mimetic faculty, the Sminetisha from Milton, very much so. And for Van Gogh is of course Kafka. So if you wanted that, what I'm actually saying is Kafka, Benjamin, Goethe, a peculiar sort of combination. But of course, what I do not deny at all is that secular democracy, with its insistence on strong institutions, does require a certain way of organizing the world. That I agree. I only question whether this organization is based on the epistemological concept of either or multiple possibilities, which are the Sobola is our principle. Take language, for instance. I could not deal with that wonderful text in which somebody in the Habsburg monarchy is faced by a questioner who says, which language do you speak in at home? And then he's puzzled by this question because they speak six or seven languages at home. So which should he choose? His answer is neutral. He cannot answer that question. So I'm saying that the secular democracy, if it has requires strong institutions, must have classificatory orders which are also meaningful for a polyvalent, polycultural sort of a world. And I think that is possible, because if you take the kind of question that some of our passport people, etc., want to answer and all that, there's no rationality behind it. So I'm only questioning the claim to rationality of the questionnaires that are sent out by the government, which is definitely a democratic government. So the debate would be then there. No? I mean, how sensible it is to ask this question then? As far as your question is concerned, I think I absolutely agree with you that there are productive notions which lose their productivity and unproductive notions which become productive over time. Certainly. And as far as multiculturalism in Germany is concerned, yes, it is true. At the time when it was a rallying call for the left in Germany to, on the one hand, to attack conservative notions of these are foreigners and they have no place in Germany, so unless they become a part of the Leitkultur. It was a progressive call, but what was not realized was that this multiculturalism would be, as it were, co-opted by the conservative forces in this order. In other words, multiculturalism did help, and most of the writers who have emerged out of Germany or changed the landscape of writing in Germany, who are of foreign origin in some way or the other, They are a product of this multiculturalism. So I'm absolutely, my criticism, I would not say that the historical achievement of multiculturalism is something that I would derive, because I'm also against the Schmelztiegel kind of concept. But I'm saying that this claim that multiculturalism would actually be a rational and as if a progressive and democratic contribution to a different kind of a German society has to a large extent not materialized, and I think that is because at the of this co-option of the multicultural scheme by power hierarchies within culture, affirming them. And basically what I have in mind is Berlin. Everything that I'm talking about is based on what I know a little bit about Berlin. That's what I'm trying to say. But this is not to suggest that the young people in Berlin may find it possibility to develop, in my sense of the term, these lines of solidarity which break down these ghettos which are coming up, etc., etc., so that you have a new young generation which has a hedonistic kind of a way of dealing with these problems. I do not deny it. But I'm saying at present, to defend multiculturalism is in fact defending the claim of certain clerics, or not, I do not want to say any specific religion, certain representatives. They claim to be representatives of groups which should be left alone until they themselves can give the blessings to the state. And this is precisely what the CDU government did when it had this conference which Schäuble had organized, by choosing people as representatives and celebrating this as a tremendously progressive act, which it was not. It was only giving legitimization to certain people who were completely discredited in their own community to some extent. And India does the same thing. It is not the German thing. India does the same thing when it says that we negotiate when it comes to the question of minorities with certain people who are the representatives of minorities. And that is the Imam X from this place, or that is the priest X from the other religion. So we know who to deal with because they control them. They control their vote banks. That is the way it works. And that is what I was preaching. So I agree. It's possible that it can again be revived in a different way.
Okay. Well, if it's all sorts of things are possible, and you mentioned hedonism just now, and I think perhaps we've had heterogeneity and we've had homogeneity, so I think perhaps we might now have a third H and move on to hedonism.
Yes, of course.
There is a reception which has been laid on for us in Café Humanities. I'd suggest that we now adjourn and continue this debate there, but not before we've said a very strong thank you to